So welcome to another PyKudos. Today we have Kieran Lee, who's currently a PhD student at Oxford, to tell us about computation in generalized probabilistic theories.
Just thanks to the organizers for giving me the opportunity to speak today. And this talk is based on a paper of the same name. The archive reference is just there. And it's joint work with John Barrett. Before I start, I just want to give a brief kind of outline of the structure of today's talk. I'm going to start with some brief motivations, then I'm going to introduce the problem, then I'm going to discuss a framework that will allow us to pose this problem in a rigorous fashion, then I'll talk about some results that we have. Okay, so quantum theory offers dramatic new advantages for information processing tasks. And this kind of raises the question of what broad relationships exist between information processing advantages and physical principles. And there's been much progress made on understanding the connections between physical principles and some information theoretic tasks, such as cryptography and communication complexity problems. And these insights have actually led to device-independent cryptography, among other things. So these questions not only have kind of foundational interest, but some of them have been shown to have practical implications as well. So despite this, relatively little has been learned about the connection between physical principles and computation. Most previous investigations into kind of computation beyond the usual quantum formalism have kind of focused around modifications of quantum theory. And these modifications, you know, appear to have immense computational power and kind of come with unphysical consequences. So for example, nonlinear quantum theory appears to be able to solve NP complete problems efficiently. Closed time-like curves also have this ability. But in today's talk, we're going to discuss computation in a framework that's essentially general enough to accommodate arbitrary operational theories, where an operational theory here essentially specifies some set of laboratory devices that you can connect together in different ways and assigns probabilities to different outcomes. So now we can talk about the kind of problem that I'm going to discuss today. So the class of problems that are efficiently solvable by a quantum computer is usually denoted by BQP. And this here is the best known upper bound on this class. So this class here, AWPP, is just some classical complexity class. We don't need to worry about the definition. Just know that this thing is the best known upper bound on the class of problems that a quantum computer can efficiently solve. And AWPP is contained in these more well-known classes, PP and P space. Again, the definitions aren't important. Just know that this is the best known upper bound for this class. So here's the definitions of PP and P space. They're not really important, just to remind people if they've forgotten and they want to know. So P space is essentially all problems that can be solved by a classical computer using only a polynomial amount of memory. Okay, so the problem that I want to discuss today is essentially, what's the minimal set of physical principles such that efficient computation in an operational theory satisfies the previous inclusions? So by the previous inclusions, I mean this thing here. So this question isn't well posed at the moment because I haven't said what efficient computation in an operational theory is. So in order to do that, we're going to have to discuss the framework for generalized probabilistic theories. So today we're going to work in the circuit framework, which is developed by Lucian Hardy and some people from the group in Pavia. And the framework comes with two parts, an operational part and a probabilistic part. So we're going to start with the operational part. Tests and systems are kind of taken as the primitive notions in the operational theory, where a test is essentially represents one use of a physical device, where a physical device is essentially comes with an input port and output ports, and it comes equipped with a classical pointer on top. When we use a physical device, the classical pointer ends up in one of a finite number of positions, essentially indicating that some event has occurred. So we can think of these tests as some collection of events, and we write it like this, where these I's are the different kind of classical outcomes. And systems label these input and output ports on these devices, and they come in different types, so A, B, and C. And a nice thing about this circuit framework is we can diagrammatically represent tests like this. So this would represent a test with input system type A, output system type B, and then these I's here denote the different classical outcomes that the pointer can be in when the device is used. So we can also draw specific events diagrammatically as well. So here, EI is a specific pointer reading at the very end of using this device, and this is the event that has occurred as a consequence. So we can talk about preparation events, which are essentially events from a trivial system. By trivial system, I mean essentially no system, into some other system B. And we describe these like this with this kind of pointed arrow here. And algebraically, we write this using some sort of Dirac-like notation, except instead of an angular bracket, we use a curly bracket, because it could be essentially different from quantum state. And we'd write this diagrammatic notation algebraically like that. We can also talk about observation events, which are essentially events from some system to the trivial system. And again, we can use Dirac-like notation like this to denote these things algebraically. And we'll see further on that these things, in some sense, will represent outcomes of a measurement. Okay, so we can now compose tests sequentially if the output port of the first test has the same type as the input port of the second test. So the types here have to match in order for them to be composed sequentially. And we can also compose them in parallel, and we draw that like this. Okay, so in an operational theory, we can draw circuits that kind of represent the connections of physical devices in some experiment, like so. And we can also write down diagrams that represent the specific outcomes that happened in said experiment, like that. Okay, so that's the operational part. Now we're going to discuss the probabilistic structure that we can put on top of these circuits. So a kind of minimal requirement of a physical theory is that it should be able to like ascribe probabilities to the different possible outcomes that can happen in certain experiments. So we should demand that closed circuits like this correspond to probabilities. So this here would correspond to the joint probability of preparing this event, sigma I, and getting this event, lambda j here. So this is a joint probability distribution over the classical outcomes associated with each thing. And the nice thing about this probabilistic structure is that it essentially allows us to talk about, to say when two events are equivalent. So we can say two events, E0 and E1, are equivalent if we can replace E0 with E1 in every closed circuit and not change the probabilities. So in some sense, this means that those two events, E0 and E1, we can't distinguish them in any experiment that we could conceive of in this theory, so we should call them the same. They should be equivalent. And we call equivalence classes of events taken in this fashion transformations. And so we can now look at the kind of set of transformations from some system type A to some system type B, and we denote this set like this. We can also talk about the equivalence, the set of equivalence classes of preparation events, which we call states. So here, it's a state is essentially a transformation from the trivial system to this system. So we'd represent this like this. So this is like the set of states. And then equivalence classes of observation events we call effects. Okay, so another nice feature of this probabilistic structure is it gives us a linear structure on top of these states, on top of these sets. So we can say what it means for some transformation T to be a linear combination of a transformation T0 and T1 with this kind of real number OR here. And that's defined as follows. So given some closed circuit that includes T, we'd write the probability of that as P of T. Now, if we replace the transformation T with the transformation T0 in that closed circuit and write down the probability of that as this, and do the same by replacing T0 with T1 in that circuit and write down the probability like this. If it turns out that the probability that T would have given in that closed circuit is equal to this sum, where this OR is some real number, and this holds true for every closed circuit, we can then say that the transformation T is equal to this linear sum of these two transformations here. So we can now kind of linearly extend these sets of transformations to real vector spaces. And that's kind of given to us by this probabilistic structure, which is kind of nice. So we can also talk about the vector space achieved by like linearly extending the set of states, and also the vector space that we got from linearly extending the set of effects.
So, I mean, I would have thought that the probabilistic structure would, you get that just for convex combinations.
So we don't necessarily, so the difference between kind of this circuit framework and the usual convex framework is that we don't have convexity or impose convexity from the start. So this here is actually just, it's not a convex combination, it's just some linear combination with some real scaling factor here. And it comes about by kind of changing taking T out of a closed circuit and inputting this and getting this probability, then taking that out and inputting T1 and doing that. If it turns out that this probability equals these two probabilities, where this is some real number, I mean, this can be a negative number as well if this probability is big enough and this probability is small enough. It doesn't have to be a convex combination at all. The nice thing about this circuit framework is we can actually impose convexity on top of the structure. It's not there from the start.
But I mean, somehow you have to... But I guess the point is that you can't take arbitrary combinations of T0 and T1, or you'll get probabilities that are outside the 0-1 range.
Sure, yeah. So it has to be the case that, you know, this sum of probabilities equals this probability, which is a well-defined probability. And I mean, it could turn out that for certain combinations, this OR is 1 or this OR is 0, but it can turn out in certain circumstances that this probability is kind of big enough and this one is small enough such that we can put in a negative number here and this thing is still a well-defined probability. So this kind of does define a well-defined linear combination with an arbitrary real number in there.
I mean, sorry, you mean that... in principle, you can have such combinations that exist.
Yeah. Maybe not in everything.
It's closed under linearity in the sense that you can't take, I mean, it doesn't have, there's not a linear structure on the space of events, I guess.
No, sure, yeah. So I should re-say this. So given that we can take certain linear combinations of transformations that give us another transformation defined in this fashion, we can then go back to the set of transformations here, and then take all linear combinations of transformations in there that are allowed by the theory, and then that thing will then be closed. So we kind of take the linear closure of all the transformations in there, and that becomes our real vector space.
Okay, but those linear combinations, some of them may not represent actual kind of circuit substitutions.
Yeah. So it could be the case that by taking certain combinations, you get kind of outside the set of transformations, and then those new transformations wouldn't be physical transformations in your theory yet. So it's kind of this set of kind of allowed transformations in your theory will be some sort of subset. Will be some subset of this real vector space, and it mightn't be a subspace. It could just be some subset in this thing. Yeah. And the same happens for states and effects. Okay, so we're going to assume from now on that all vector spaces are finite dimensional. So that's kind of a standing assumption that we'll use for the rest of the talk. So now, given this probabilistic structure, we can kind of associate joint probabilities to events occurring in some experiment like this. So here's, you know, a diagram representing the events that took place in some experiment. This corresponds to a joint probabilities distribution. And kind of algebraically, I can denote this joint distribution like this. So I prepare some state here. I have some effect occurring here. This transformation occurs here. And then I have no transformation here, which I'm representing here by this I. We should note that this tensor product symbol isn't the vector space tensor product. It's just some kind of notation that denotes that this transformation here, this EJ tensor IC, is just the kind of parallel composition of the two transformations here. Okay, so this is kind of, we can kind of see occurring now, every transformation from some system A to some system B will induce a linear map from this real vector space to this real vector space. So once we fix a basis, each transformation will have a matrix representation. Okay, so we've talked about this kind of operational theory of circuits with this probabilistic structure put on top. And we're going to talk about one more physical principle that we'll add into this, and we'll call all those things then generalized probabilistic theories. So a theory satisfies tomographic locality if every transformation can be fully characterized by local process tomography. This essentially means that given some transformation, I can fully characterize that transformation by inputting product states and performing product effect measurements on the end. So if we kind of think about this transformation as a state, so setting all these systems to the trivial system, essentially tomographic locality boils down to the ability to perfectly characterize this set, this state, by performing local measurements. So this is just the generalization of that to transformations. Okay, and the nice thing about tomographic locality is it gives us a simple way to talk about the kind of parallel composition of transformations. So we saw this circuit a few slides back, and now if we kind of fix a basis for all the vector spaces, we can write down the actual vector corresponding to each of these things, or the matrix corresponding to each of these things. So I prepared the state, which essentially corresponds to some column vector here, which we denote by M. And then this measurement here is a row vector, which is denoted here. Now the matrix for this transformation here is this M, and then I tensor it with the identity matrix on this system. Now this symbol here is the actual vector space tensor product. So, and from now on we'll kind of write this M tensor I just as a new matrix. So essentially local tomography is giving us the ability to kind of relate this matrix, this compound transformation, to the matrices of the original two transformations in a simple way via this vector space tensor product. Okay, so from now on we're going to assume that tomographic locality is satisfied. So when I say generalized probabilistic theory, I mean this operational theory with these circuits, with this probabilistic structure and tomographic locality. So they're all my standing assumptions. So now we're going to talk about one last thing before we move on to some results. The nice thing about this kind of Hardy-Pavia framework is that a kind of notion of causality isn't implicit in the framework already. You can impose it. You can articulate what it means for a certain theory to satisfy a notion of causality. And moreover, you can actually discuss theories that don't satisfy this notion of causality. So we'll say a generalized probabilistic theory is causal if the probability of a preparation event is independent of the choice of which observation test follows the preparation. So essentially what this means algebraically is if I have two observation tests, lambda and theta, and I prepare some state, sigma I, then these two sums should be the same. Now if we kind of look at each term of the sum, essentially what it is the joint probability of preparing the state I and seeing this effect, lambda j, happen. And so this sum essentially corresponds to marginalizing over that joint probability distribution to get to the probability of preparing this state. So essentially, the probability of this preparation should be independent of which choice of observation test we use. So roughly, in some sense, we can think about this notion of causality as kind of being a no signaling from the future type of principle. Because if it turned out that the probability of preparation depended on a choice happening later in the circuit, then we kind of detect that and send signals from a later stage in the circuit to an earlier stage in the circuit. But there's nothing obviously pathological about theories without causality. I mean, there's nothing in the framework that we've discussed so far that kind of compels us to interpret circuits as some sequence of tests or events applied in some temporal order. And this temporal order actually matches the order of composition in our circuits. There's nothing that kind of compels us to do that. And there's nothing obviously pathological about theories that don't satisfy that. So from now on, unless stated explicitly otherwise, we will not assume our theories are causal. It could turn out to be. So usually if a theory is causal, that's equivalent to there existing a so-called unique deterministic effect, the effect essentially of kind of I just throw away my system at the end. And this kind of corresponds to, in quantum theory, if I have a measurement that corresponds to P of M, I can add all my P of M elements together and they should equal to the identity. Essentially mean that the probability is sum to one. And so the identity here would be the unique deterministic effect. So essentially something happened in my measurement. Now I can consider theories that have two deterministic effects. So in these theories, weird things like what would happen, like I have two choices of ways to marginalize over a bipartite state, and that'll give me two different reduced states, and this allows me to kind of signal from the future to the past. So you can like mathematically write down theories that have more than one deterministic effect, and they'd essentially be non-causal theories. Usually all the theories you talk about have a unique deterministic effect. In the other kind of framework of generalized probabilistic theory, the kind of convex sets framework, it's kind of given in at the start that you have this unique deterministic effect. But in the nice thing about this circuit framework is you don't have to do that. So you can actually talk about theories in a kind of sensible way that don't have a unique deterministic effect, and thus we can send signals from the future to the past in some sense. Like that. Yeah.
is it clear, is the circuit framework you're using one, are the violations of causality you're imagining really necessarily kind of retrocausal influences, or should I think of your circuit framework as more abstract than that? And so, for instance, if I imagine having a gate which I can plug into a breadboard that has a slot, well, that breadboard can be thought of as a transformation on the gate, which I could draw in an abstract way as just a transformation of some preparation.
Yeah.
So should I think of your circuit framework as including cones and breadboards as particular transformations? And if that's the case, then there's no reason I should think causality holds.
Yeah.
Because, so is that an example?
Essentially, yeah. So in this paper where they introduce the cones, they're essentially using this framework to discuss them.
Yep.
There are certain examples of kind of transformations on transformations, such as this switch transformation that can't fit into the circuit framework. And so those kind of notions of kind of indefinite causal structure don't apply here, because we do have a fixed kind of structure which is given by the circuit, but still the kind of intuitive notion of causality is the thing here kind of happens and the thing here is influenced by this thing, but this original thing can't be influenced by anything that happens at a later stage in the circuit is the kind of notion of causality I mean. So yeah, so they would include combs and things of that sort.
Risk of bogging things down here. So why have you decided to give tomographic vocality, why have you elevated this to the status of like an axiom, but
yeah,
not causality?
Yeah, yeah. So it'll turn out in kind of theorems we prove that we'll need tomographic locality, or at least a version of it, for the proofs to go through, but we don't need a notion of causality. So we'll kind of, the question I pose at the start is, what's the best upper bound on efficient computation in these generalized probabilistic theories? To prove the best upper bounds, we'll need a notion of tomographic locality, but it turns out that a notion of causality isn't required. So that's essentially why. Okay, any more questions? Okay, so let's just see a brief example of a generalized probabilistic theory. So quantum theory would satisfy this. So our systems in quantum theory are kind of finite dimensional complex Hilbert spaces, and the system type is just the dimension of the Hilbert space. The kind of real vector space given rise to from the states is just the real vector space for Hermitian operators. So essentially it's our density matrices. And tests are just collections of completely positive trace non-increasing maps. So quantum instruments essentially. And effects, observation tests are POVMs. And this framework is general enough to kind of accommodate classical probability theory and stochastic maps, and also more general examples like box world and these other things like this. Okay, so we know we can draw circuits kind of that kind of describe the experimental setup, but what do we need for these circuits to be a meaningful model of computation? How do we talk about efficient computation using these circuits? And what we're going to need is a kind of definition or a notion of a uniform family of circuits for generalized probabilistic theory. Okay, so in the kind of the quantum and classical circuit models, a circuit family is indexed by some positive integer n, and this n is essentially the size of the input state to the circuit. And as kind of the usual interpretation of this circuit family is that the state encodes the problem you want to solve. You plug this into a circuit, run the computation, do a measurement, and see if you can solve the problem or not. And each circuit is built by composing a polynomial number of gates. But in a generalized probabilistic theory, we're kind of not assuming a notion of causality. So these circuits really don't have any direction to them. So it kind of doesn't really make sense to say that the input state to the circuit encodes the problem. We'll need something a bit more general than that. So what we're going to say is that in a generalized circuit model, the entire circuit will encode the problem. So there will be some classical bit or classical string x that will encode the problem, and then our whole circuit then will depend on this x, not just the size of the input state. We could also talk about quantum theory like this, and it really doesn't make that much of a difference, but kind of because we're not assuming causality, it's more natural to kind of assume this notion of circuit family. And it might not be the case that there's any finite gate set that's universal for an arbitrary generalized probabilistic theory in the way that kind of single system and bipartite transformations are universal for quantum theory. But nevertheless, we're going to define a circuit family as being built by composing a polynomial number of gates from some finite gate set. just to make things a bit simpler. Okay, so we need to impose two more conditions for our circuit families to be called uniform. And the first one essentially means that given some matrix that represents a gate in our circuit, we can efficiently compute the entries of that gate. So a Turing machine essentially can, given which matrix it is, can kind of output matrix entries that are good approximations to the original matrix entries in some efficient manner. And this is kind of, you know, based on a physical principle that if we have these gates or these physical transformations in our lab, we're never going to be able to perfectly employ them or use them perfectly. So there will always be a little bit of error. So this is kind of capturing that in some sense. And our last requirement for a circuit family to be uniform is that given the kind of input that kind of encodes the problem, a Turing machine can efficiently output a classical description of this circuit in polytime. And this is essentially the same as the kind of the uniformity condition we'd use in classical or quantum theory as well. So there's nothing in this uniformity condition that's not in the quantum or classical uniformity definitions. We've changed one little bit, but we could also think about quantum theory as having that thing. So there's nothing really, there's no new assumptions that are being snuck in here in this uniformity condition. They're essentially the same as the quantum ones. Okay, so we have now a notion of uniformity, but we're going to need a notion of kind of acceptance. When will these circuits be said to accept a certain computational problem or an outcome of the circuit? So in quantum computation, kind of all our gates are deterministic, and we can postpone measurements to the end of the circuit without loss of generality. We'd say that a quantum circuit would accept some input if a measurement of the first output qubit is zero. But in an arbitrary generalized probabilistic theory, there's no reason to say that we can postpone measurements to the end of the computation. And we can't say that without loss of generality. So we'll need slightly more general notion of acceptance criterion in this case. So a kind of way we can envisage generalized probabilistic theory solving some computational problem would be as follows. So given the classical bit string X that kind of encodes the problem, we go away and design and build a circuit CX, which could, you know, look something like this. So we compose a polynomial number of gates from our finite gate set. We have some kind of states, we have some effects like this. And then we run the computation. So when we run the computation, each of the kind of classical pointers on each of the transformations will give some classical value. And so then we can associate a joint probability to all these outcomes. So this is like the probability of getting outcome OR1 on this state, etc. And we can write this algebraically like this. Okay, so how do we know when such a circuit would accept? Well, we're going to need a way of partitioning all the possible kind of outcomes of the circuit into two subsets, an accepting and a rejecting subset. So the way in which we'll do that is, given a function A here, given the kind of output of a circuit, this function will tell us if this circuit accepts or rejects by giving you a 0 or 1 for accepting or rejecting. And we'll kind of demand that this function can be efficiently computed by a Turing machine, which essentially corresponds to the requirement that the way in which we partition these outcomes shouldn't kind of encode a hard problem. So the way in which it's partitioned shouldn't kind of encode a solution to some really hard computational problem. And that's where this constraint comes from. I mean, if you think this is too strong a constraint, we could kind of restrict the power of the Turing machine that can efficiently compute this function. But for this talk, it really doesn't matter. All we need to know is that the way in which we partition this outcome set is efficient in some sense and doesn't encode something hard. Okay, so we can now say what the probability for a computation to accept a given input is, or a given classical string. It's just summing over all the kind of accepting outputs, the probability of the accepting outputs from your circuit, like this. Okay, so now we're finally in a place to define what it means for a theory to, what it means for a generalized probabilistic theory to have efficient computation. So we'll say for a given generalized probabilistic theory G, a language L is in the class BGP. So this is like, you know, the analog of BQP in the quantum case. If there exists some polynomial size uniform family of circuits and an efficient acceptance criterion, such that, you know, if some string X is in the language, then our circuits accept with probability at least 2/3. If X is not in the language, then our circuit will accept with probability at most 1/3. You know, and these coefficients here are really arbitrary. We can kind of run the computation many times and amplify these if we'd like. Okay, so now essentially the question I posed at the start of the talk is well posed. We can now say what it means for theory to have efficient computation. And it turns out that efficient computation in all these theories actually satisfies the quantum upper bounds. So the only assumptions that have gone into our theory so far have been the circuit framework with the probabilistic structure and tomographic locality. We haven't assumed the notion of causality or anything else. And yet we still kind of satisfy the best known quantum bounds, which is maybe surprising, maybe not. Okay, so I'm just going to give a brief kind of sketch of the inclusion in p-space, just so we can see the role of our assumptions, how they kind of allow us to prove these things. And I should kind of say that the proofs of all these are essentially the same as the proofs of the quantum cases, except it's kind of taking the quantum proof and formulating it in a theory-independent way, and then they essentially go through with no real problem, as we'll see in the case of p-space. Okay, so this is a kind of a rough sketch of the p-space proof. So consider some circuit CX with some polynomial number of gates from our finite gate set. What we're going to do is we're going to tensor these gates with identity transformations on systems on which they don't act, and pad them with like rows and columns of zeros, so that at the end we're left with a sequence of kind of square matrices here, where this kind of matrix, this notation means that this matrix M upper script or N is the kind of matrix representing this or nth outcome of the nth gate. Okay, and so obviously the kind of the first matrix here corresponds to the state preparation. So this big matrix will only be non-zero on the first column and have zeros everywhere else, because the state will be a column vector and stuff like that. Okay, so now our uniformity condition essentially, you know, assures that the matrix entries of gates from G, we can kind of efficiently compute them. The nice thing about tomographic locality is it gives us a way to efficiently compute the entries of these matrices, because we know that all we did, we have this tensor product structure, so we just tensored the original gates from G with identities. And so because we can efficiently compute these ones, we can efficiently now compute these ones by this tensor product structure. Okay, so the probability to get some outcome here, so this kind of, you know, outcome, yeah?
Sorry, can I pause you for a second? Why do you need tomographic locality to get that implication on the previous slide?
So I'll kind of discuss that in more detail on, I think, two slides away, and you kind of see where that kind of, you see that without tomographic locality, that conclusion wouldn't follow. So it kind of seems kind of obvious that it should, right, because we're so used to thinking about quantum theory and combining via tensor product is really the only thing you can do. But you can actually consider theories where there is no tensor product structure, and so the kind of matrix corresponding to some compound transformation, there's no easy way to relate that matrix to matrix of the individual transformations that gave rise to it, which is kind of, yeah, strange from a quantum viewpoint. But yeah, so I'll discuss that in a bit more detail in like two slides, I think. So the probability of getting, you know, these outcomes on all the gates is given by just, you know, multiplying all these matrices together. And this B here just ensures that because we padded it with rows and columns of zeros, that we get back the kind of column vector of the state at the start, so that this thing will actually be a number. So just doing the matrix multiplication will give us some exponentially long sum, but each term in the sum will only have polynomially many terms, things multiplied together, because our circuit had polynomially many gates. And we've argued that, you know, these matrix entries can be efficiently computed. So because each term can be efficiently calculated, it'll take a polynomial amount of space to calculate all these terms, because it'll take, you know, it's efficient to do this, then to do all these things, there's polynomial amount of them, so it'll take polynomial amount of memory. But this implies that the entire sum can be calculated in polynomial space, because individual terms can be erased after being added to the running total. So it might take an exponential amount of time, but only a polynomial amount of space. This is essentially, I mean, the same proof as the quantum case, but we kind of have formulated in theory kind of independent language. Okay, so it's kind of nice now to discuss the role of our assumptions, so kind of where our physical assumptions came into play in that proof. So we saw the linear structure was kind of really important, right? Because to write down the probability was just matrix multiplication, right? So we could have done that if we didn't have this linear structure. And the linear structure really arose from the requirement that a physical theory should give probabilistic predictions about the outcomes of certain events. So that kind of really basic requirement of physical theory gave us this linear structure, which we kind of used in our proof. And also to answer Gus's question, it kind of required the ability to compute efficiently the entries of matrices representing transformations applied in parallel from the individual matrices of these transformations. So in general, in a theory that's not tomographically local, if we have some transformation from some system A to some system B, and this transformation acts on kind of one half of a bipartite system, which I'll call AC, there may in general be no simple way to relate that linear map, so the linear map from the kind of the bipartite system AC to the bipartite system BC, to the action of the transformation when it's applied to system A on its own. So the tomographic locality gave us this tensor product structure that allowed us to kind of relate the matrix acting from A to B to the matrix acting from AC to BC, because it's just, you know, tensoring the identity here. But in general, without tomographic locality, that's not the case.
So is this property equivalent to tomographic?
No. So tomographic locality implies that we can do it, but there's examples of theories that aren't tomographically local but still have a tensor product structure.
Because it seems like this is really the important
part. Yeah, exactly. So this is why when you asked your question, why tomographic locality, they said we need a notion of tomographic locality for our proof to go through. And so it'd be kind of interesting to kind of weaken the tomographic locality principle to essentially saying this, because that's all we need for the proof. So you can kind of think about weaker notions of tomographic locality that still let this proof go through, and it might be interesting to kind of explore those a little bit. Yeah, so like an example of a theory that has a tensor product structure but isn't tomographically local is real quantum theory. So there you have this nice property, but you don't have tomographic locality. Okay, so they're the kind of two, they're kind of where our two assumptions came into play in this proof, and they come into play in a very similar way in the proofs of the inclusion in the other two classes as well. But note that we didn't need a notion of causality at all in our proof or the way we were talking about it, which is kind of nice. Okay, so we're going to extend our computational model slightly. So Aronson has introduced the notion of post-selected quantum computation. These essentially are circuits with a post-selected register. And the way in which this is defined is only those runs of the computation in which a measurement of the post-selected register or a qubit yields zero are considered. So we throw away all other runs. So practically speaking, the way you'd implement this in a lab would be to run your computation many, many, many times and only consider those runs where you got the outcome you wanted. So essentially, it could take you an exponential amount of time to get the outcome you wanted, but with post-selecting, that happens in one run. So this is kind of where the power of this model comes from. But in a nice way, Aronson also proved that, you know, this class, this post-selected quantum computation, which I'll denote like this, is actually equal to this class PP. So while post-selection makes quantum computers more powerful than they were originally, it doesn't make them ridiculously powerful, too powerful. They can't compute everything, essentially. But if we kind of interpret this, this is a nice interpretation in terms of the results we've been talking about today, because now a quantum computer with post-selection can essentially simulate computation in any generalized probabilistic theory, which is kind of nice. So giving quantum theory the ability to post-select measurement results allows it to simulate computation in any theory in our framework. We can say slightly more than this. We can define the kind of notion of post-selection in our generalized probabilistic theory, which essentially we can post-select on any subset of our circuit outcome. So instead of post-selecting on the outcome of a register at the end, we do a measurement, we can post-select on any kind of subset of outcomes from our circuit, as long as that subset can be efficiently computed. And it turns out that we can actually prove that this class, the post-selected computation or generalized probabilistic theories, is contained in this class PP, which is, you know, equal to this class post-selected quantum computation. So we can interpret this as saying that in a world with post-selection, quantum theory is optimal for computation in the space of all generalized probabilistic theories. And the kind of nice thing about this proof is this proof was different to the quantum case. So this is the way we proved this was genuinely different. Compared to the case of all the other proofs, which are essentially the same quantum proof. So it'd be nice if we could interpret this result here, you know, that post-selective quantum computation is optimal for computation in the space of all generalized probability theories with post-selection, as a kind of way of saying that quantum theory on its own is optimal, or at least powerful, for computation in the space of all general theories. So if we could say such a thing, it might be kind of a nice intuition for saying where the quantum speed up comes from in some sense, maybe, maybe not. But it would be nice to know something like this. So can we view the previous result as evidence to support this conjecture or not? So it turns out that we should be a bit cautious, as the following example will show. So if we consider the one clean qubit model, which is essentially a restricted form of quantum computation where the input to the circuit consists of one pure qubit and as many maximally mixed states as you desire, and we define, we kind of denote this class as DQC. So as you can imagine, I mean, under reasonable assumptions, this model of computation is not universal computation in quantum theory. So it's, you know, this, there are certain problems outside of this class that are in quantum. But interestingly enough, you can actually show that when given post-selection, when given the ability to post-select measurement outcomes, these classes become equivalent, which is kind of strange. So post-selection is you know, a subtle thing going on here. So while it's the case that, you know, quantum theory of post-selection is included in the one clean qubit model of post-selection, it's not the case that quantum theory is included in the one clean qubit model. So we should really be careful if we want to view our previous result as evidence that quantum theory is kind of powerful or optimal for computation in the space of all probabilistic theories. Okay, so there's like a few other results you can prove in this framework that I won't go into too much detail here. One is that, you know, imposing non-trivial reversible transformations on a theory implies that theory can simulate classical random computation. And the kind of oracles play a really important role in quantum computation. They kind of form the basis of the best known separations between classical and quantum theory. So it'd be really nice to have a notion of kind of computational oracle in this generalized probabilistic framework. It turns out that it's really hard to define such a notion properly, but one can define a kind of notion of classical oracle like this, which I won't go into too much detail here. But you can actually, interestingly enough, prove a separation result involving these classical oracles. So you can prove that there exists some classical oracle A, such that for all causal theory, so I'm imposing this kind of causality assumption here, it turns out that relative to this oracle, NP is not contained in these theories. So kind of this, in some sense, could support the conjecture that kind of generalized probabilistic theories that satisfy local tomography and causality mightn't be able to solve NP-complete problems. So kind of in conclusion today, what we've done is we've defined a class of problems that can be efficiently solved by some arbitrary generalized probabilistic theory. And we've shown that theories that satisfy, you know, principle of tomographic locality or even a weaker principle than that, kind of satisfy the best known upper bounds in the class on the kind of power of quantum computation. And also we've seen in a world with post-selection, quantum theory is optimal for computation in amongst all these theories. So what should we kind of make in this? So we've kind of seen that the best known upper bounds on this follow from really, really mild assumptions. So I wouldn't consider tomographic locality to be too big of an assumption. And so we've seen that kind of the proofs on the best known upper bounds of these don't really exploit any uniquely quantum features. We don't even need a notion of causality. So kind of one consequence of this work would be, could we do better? Is there a way that we can harness more uniquely quantum features to prove better upper bounds? I'm not sure. So and one more interesting question could be, even though we haven't assumed the causality principle, the gates in our circuit still appear in a fixed structure. So it would be cool to investigate the kind of computational power of theories in which there is no definite structure. So models like this have been proposed by Lucian Hardy for like potential models of quantum gravity. So it'd be interesting to look at computational power where we kind of relax this fixed structure and see how powerful can computers and circuits be in those situations. Okay, so and two more interesting questions would be, can quantum theory simulate computation in any generalized probabilistic theory? if this were the case, I mean, could that provide some evidence for where this quantum speedup over classical comes from? I guess that's still an open question. And more to the point, because we have so much freedom in building these generalized probabilistic theories, can we kind of construct a generalized probabilistic theory that has more computational power than quantum theory? Or could it solve a hard problem, like an NP complete problem? That's kind of ongoing work we're working on at the moment. So thanks very much for your attention today. That's my talk.
Further questions for Kieran?
So the big picture of what you've been talking about is trying to identify features of general probabilistic theories that contain you within these complex classes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So sort of providing upper bounds on the computational power of GPTs.
Yeah.
Have you thought at all about principles that give you lower bounds on your computational power? So, you know, for the features you pointed out, you know, I could talk about the stabilizer formalism or, you know, a classical operational theory, and they would all satisfy it, so
yeah.
They'd have the same upper bounds, but they're not as powerful as the
sure.
generic.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious whether you've,
So the kind of one small problem about this is that the way we've talked about the acceptance condition is that we said that, you know, given some outcome, we want to see that accepts or not, so there should be some function that tells us if it accepts or not. But if we kind of impose that this function should be computed by some classical Turing machine, then if we have some probabilistic theory that essentially has no computational power, so there's no real powerful computation there, we're still allowing it to do at least the power of P with this transformation here.
Okay.
So in a sense, what we've described so far, the kind of lower bound is this classical class P. But I mean, that's not really nice. We'd like to talk about the intrinsic power of a probabilistic theory rather than the kind of the way we've defined the acceptance criterion. So you could weaken this to be, you know, as weak as you want, essentially, while still doing it. So I'd say the lower bound would definitely be how powerful you want the kind of Turing machine that kind of efficiently outputs this thing to be. But there are examples like Box World, in which when you talk about reversible computation, there's no non-trivial reversible computation. So there, everything can be computed by P. So I guess a conjecture could. So yeah, I'm not sure. It'd be interesting to kind of see, given some physical principle, that would imply that all GPTs are at least as powerful as this class. So one kind of thing we did was, where is this? Yeah. So when you impose the kind of that there exist non-trivial reversible transformations, then all theories that satisfy that are lower bounded by classical probabilistic computation. So there are other principles like this purification principle of the Pavia group that also imply this, and things like that. Yeah.
Sorry, I mean that it seems from what you just said that kind of putting in explicitly that it has access to a classical machine.
Yeah.
So this result that BPP is included in BGP.
Yeah, it seems
kind of trivial.
Yeah. So the way in which I like to interpret this is the fact that it's the kind of real intrinsic power of the theory that can simulate this thing, and it doesn't use this ability to kind of use a P machine to partition this outcome set. And we can weaken that that condition by saying, well, the Turing machine can only compute certain functions, so it restricts the power from P to something smaller than P, which is the way I like to think about it. So I like to restrict that kind of the power of that Turing machine to as weak as possible, kind of talk about more so the intrinsic power of the theory rather than the theory that uses this Turing machine to do something.
Like
yeah.
You could say, like for most cases that we like to consider, you can imagine like you just have, you know, intuitively you just have one bit and that bit tells you the answer to the problem. And so like that thing could be decided by like a constant depth circuit. It doesn't have to be a polynomial sized Turing machine, right? Or like a log. So you can make that Turing machine be log space or constant.
Yeah,
depth
circuit. Or like an L parity machine or
and,
something
yeah.
like that.
Presumably
yeah.
If you made that restriction you would still get this inclusion.
Yeah, exactly. So that I guess that's the point I was trying to make, that this is kind of more intrinsic to the theory than the power of the Turing machine that can compute this acceptance function.
Okay, but then you don't need to make that assumption because it's a derived assumption. I mean If you have this statement,
mm-hmm.
you can then actually, I mean, then you have the classical
yeah.
Turing machine basically from that.
Exactly. Yeah.
From, you know, subroutine.
Now that I think of it, is there anything to be gained by having this really abstract function that is able to partition all the possible event combinations into acceptance or rejection? Or can you just say that there is, you know, one system that's designated as the special system, or one event that's designated as the special event that dictates acceptance or rejection?
I guess, so we kind of discussed that when we were writing the paper, and I guess the main problem, or maybe it's us being overcautious, but it could be the case, you could imagine some generalized probabilistic theory that kind of has the event that's like the accepting event or whatever, the kind of way that that is partitioned among the set of all possible outcomes could encode a hard problem in some sense. We weren't sure if that was ruled out by doing that or not. So you can kind of say that there is one kind of special accepting thing, but the way in which you decide that should be efficient in some sense or shouldn't be able to encode some hard problem.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if all your gates can be generated efficiently, then presumably the probabilities of all these individual events could also be computed efficiently. So I don't see a problem with that off the top of my head.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's not necessarily the probabilities of the events, it's the way in which you partition the events themselves. So we've said the kind of matrices corresponding to certain events, the entries of those can be efficiently computed, but we don't know the way in which the events change between runs of the experiment, if that isn't, if we can efficiently kind of say something about that. Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree that it seems like fine, but I'm just not sure if there's some subtle thing, if there's a way you could construct a theory that could actually satisfy other things, but the way in which you partition actually solves a hard problem, I'm not sure.
If I can move on to a different topic. I would guess that, you know, you define a measurement-based GPT model computation, and it's conceivable that the computational power for a given GPT would be different for the circuit in a measurement-based model, because you don't necessarily have a purification postulate that allows you to
between
them. So do we know anything about the relative power of circuit models and measurement-based models for GPTs?
No, actually, I don't know about it. It would be interesting to kind of explore theories where those two things are distinct. I can imagine theories that exist that do have this property. So yeah, it would be interesting to kind of talk about those.
You might need causality or something.
Yeah, if like in a measurement-based model, you kind of have adaptive circuits in some sense. You need some notion of causality to make sure you don't run into paradoxes or something like. Yeah.
Or maybe that's enough. If that's all you. So, any other questions?
How does this first thing fit in your like the theory that's just bits and pure states and permutations?
So this thing here.
Yeah.
So I guess. So the kind of classical theory that has like bits and then probabilistic transformations on probability distributions.
Like just permutations.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. So I guess all you need to be, all the kind of the only requirement you need for a theory to be able to simulate this thing, is that number one, you can perform any Boolean function. So essentially, you can do arbitrary permutations on bit strings, and number two, that you can generate random bits. So on top of that theory, you kind of need a kind of a randomness, or a way to measure something and get a certain outcome with a certain probability and a different outcome with a different probability. So the kind of theory that's just classical bits and permutations would just have P in it, not BPP.
Right, but doesn't it have non-trivial reversible transformations?
I should have specified that it's non-trivial reversible transformations and kind of non-classicalness, in that there exist states that aren't, there exists some set of state that isn't perfectly distinguishable in one shot. So in a classical theory, that would always be the case. Yeah, so I guess I should have put that up there as well, yeah.
Not a simplex state space.
Yeah. Yeah, so the conjunction of those two conditions implies this. But if you just have non-trivial reversible transformations, it's just P is in your theory.
So something just tweaked in my memory. So Scott Enstrin also has this paper where he
looks at this class where, you know, what would the power of quantum computation, what would happen to the power of quantum computation if you could sample the path of a hidden variable?
Yeah, yeah, sure, sure.
And like he, you know, this was interesting because you could do more than quantum computers,
but not too
like
much
impossible.
More. Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
I just, do you have any idea where this fits into your whole
So
analysis?
It turns out that that's not an example of a generalized probabilistic theory.
Yeah.
So he recently released a second paper with some other co-authors that kind of reinterpreted that model as saying, imagine a quantum computer and you can do measurements, but the measurements don't destroy the state or don't collapse the state. So I can do kind of as many measurements on the same state as I want and the state will never collapse. So it's essentially the same as being able to sample the history of a hidden variable. And he proved the same results for those. Because of the way that that's formulated, we can't really talk about it in this framework, I guess. But yeah, it's kind of along the same lines of going, well, it's kind of different than the kind of these investigations, because that's like, okay, I modify quantum theory, now how much powerful is it? In this case, I'm kind of considering all operationally defined theories that mightn't be related to quantum theory at all and imposing physical principles on those and then seeing how those physical principles are related to computation. Whereas he's kind of modifying quantum theory and going, well, what happens if I change this? I guess that's kind of interesting in its own right, but this is kind of a more systematic approach maybe than kind of just changing bits of quantum theory.
Any other questions? No? We'll thank Kieran again.